This is really a hard act to follow, though. Like, it's been an amazing start of the day. And I just want to say thank you while this works to both Reagan and to Carlos and to everybody who is here for organizing this and inviting me to come here. My talk today is called, does it work? That's interesting. We can try it another way.
We all like that.
Yeah, it is actually quite beautiful, I have to say. Okay, good, fine. We found out what was wrong. My talk is entitled Queer Preposterousness, We Who Feel Temporally Disoriented. And I'm not only talking about temporal disorientation as in jet lag, even though I'm definitely suffering from that as well, and that kind of syncopation. And I'm going to maybe shift the discussion a bit away from the U.S. context and a bit to Norway, the country that the name I have in my passport that I'm traveling under. Because Norway, I realized when I came here, is I actually, funded almost all of this. And I don't know, now the general consul was here yesterday. He's not here today. And I guess, Anne talked about the importance of, of criticism. So perhaps Norway doesn't like my talk. Anyway, we'll go ahead. In 2010, the Norwegian media declared queer theory to be history. A queer theoretical hegemony is over. The editor of Culture in the intellectual newspaper Morgenbladet wrote in an article. She continued, "The paradigm shift is absolute. Try to say the sentence, the war in Afghanistan isn't happening, or everything is text, or biological gender doesn't exist. You won't have any success, I promise." The truisms of postmodernism have gone from being powerful to being slightly embarrassing. The editor-in-chief of the left-wing newspaper Klassekampen formulated it in really similar terms, explaining that he shed no tears for the post-modernist hegemony, with his theoretical branches such as queer theory, where some theorists hubristically insisted that biological gender didn't exist. Now, he continued, the goal is to get back to a healthy and truth-seeking culture in academia and in the general public sphere, public sphere in general, I'm sorry. Furthermore, the editor of Culture in the largest or most important newspaper, Aftenposten, remarked and explained that he found queer theory to be nothing but wishful thinking, remarking that he couldn't think of any queer theorists in Norway who write engaged and understandable prose. Whoa. They all use a terrible, obscure, and tribal language.
Tribal.
It was the Norwegian comedian Harald Eia who initiated the criticism of queer theory in his popular TV show Brainwash that ran on the state channel NRK in the spring of 2010. Relaunching himself in this program as an investigative journalist, he created this TV show that was to test the standards of Norwegian academia by triggering a science war based on an oppositional nature versus nurture debate. That was also kind of the title of the book that came after the program. In practice, it turned out to be a show designed to glorify a certain form of evolutionary psychology and biology on behalf of specifically post-structuralist feminism and queer theory. In response to the Norwegian queer theorist Agnes Bolse's criticism that she felt abused by the program that had cut and pasted her interviews in ways that made her answer questions she actually never was posed, the program host, quipped to the newspapers, "If you are a dictator that has run the business for years, you might not be very receptive to criticism." Finally, it seemed, Norway had freed itself from the grips of the queer dictators, with their tribal language that nobody understood, and their far-out ideas that were nothing but wishful thinking. Truth would prevail. So queer theory is already dead in Norway. It is buried once and for all. After the tribe has been exposed on TV, the backwardness of its thinking and language has been made obvious for all. The anachronism has finally been cleared out by the winds of progress. You could say that this is kind of an untimely moment for those of us who work with queer theoretical and activist perspectives in Norway. Not only are we told that we have ruled the country for years, they could have told us before, maybe we would have done something, but we're also positioned as undeveloped species, speaking in this ludicrous, indecipherable tribal language. You know, paper could be made just on the racism underpinning that language, but I'll leave that now. It is indeed an untimely moment to be recognized then as a young, queer-informed researcher trying to kind of get into the academia, as it is totally obvious that I am way too late, that my material is already dated, and I'm quite out of sync with the present. Well, I, though, thought that queer theory in politics was still to be introduced, at least not put to use in the Norwegian debate. And I started a journal a couple of years ago trying to just get some of us people working with queer activism and theory to talk to each other. Seeing then the words, if definitely not content, of queer theory hit the mainstream for the first time through this series of quite preposterous obituaries made me temporarily disoriented. How to orient oneself theoretically and politically when the thing you perceive as a future possibility, as something to strive for and work towards, is time and again declared dead and buried. I have to admit, though, I attempted to relegate this quite intense and quite violent media debate in the background in order to work on my PhD project that explores how contemporary queer feminist, anti-racist activist and artist turn to historical material in order to rethink notions of politics, progress, and futurity. But I came to realize quite quickly that the context of my writing seemed to symptomize my project's focus on the political nature of historicizing and archival gestures. The violent act of cutting something off, metaphorically, practically, and systemically, from the present. Finding myself to be positioned as a kind of living anachronism in the Norwegian debate was a stark reminder of how one is not always in the position to choose to turn towards history. Often one finds oneself turned into history, situated as historical stuff in the dustbin of history. This made me start pondering questions such as, how do we know what time it is? When is the present, and when is history history? And what are the effects of positioning ongoing, unfolding, or potential future political cultures as history, as something one can look back upon retrospectively from the perspective of the present? The burial of queer politics in Norway did not really fit with any simple model of backlash, I think. It was more kind of complex than that, akin to the double movement that Angela McRobbie, in the book Aftermath of Feminism, argues has characterized the assaults on feminism in the UK, where neoliberal and conservative critics invoke and use the language of feminism only to position it as already achieved and no longer needed, a spent force. McRobbie terms this historicizing strategy one of disarticulation, that works to, quote, foreclose the possibility or likelihood of various expansive intersections and intergenerational feminist transmission. Articulations are therefore reversed, broken off, and the idea of a new feminist political imaginary is increasingly inconceivable, unquote. The Norwegian TV show and media debate can be seen, perhaps, as attempts to disarticulate queer politics in a similar way. The story of how queer theory has already been here and done its job, brainwashing the country, paves the way for the gravediggers to do their job of putting critical thinking on gender, sex, and race to rest once and for all. Of course, the thing called queer theory in the media had little or nothing to do with any existing queer theoretical or political work. The critics' totally lack of references to queer research, except for this one name, Judith Butler, this kind of monster, came up from time to time. But their lack of references to any work did not make their claim for the urgency of exorcising this theoretical monster any less powerful. Rather, almost opposite. But of course, they also said that you couldn't understand it anyway, so why should they invoke it or read it? Anyway, McRobbie argues that the effects of disarticulating and ridiculing political practices by inscribing this kind of hysterical image in its name can be quite severe. She writes, when important historical moments of liberation become somehow no longer transmissible, or when such moments are caricatured and trivialized, if not forgotten, then there is perhaps a crisis for the possibility of radical democratic politics, unquote. I'm well aware that the Norwegian media's act of putting queer theory to death is far from unique. Theories and politics are kind of killed all the time, within and beyond academia. Of course, the whole language of living, alive, the life of a theory makes it, of course, possible to kill it, I guess. So, you know, that kind of killing is part of a ritual of progress as well. Those working with queer politics, often especially habituated to such kind of burial tactics. Here in the US too, queer theory seems to be put to death in print almost every other day. But it is the banality and predictability, not the exemplarity of the Norwegian debate, that makes it an interesting case to think with. It is this generic quality of this historicizing gesture that opens up more wide-ranging questions on the effects of histories and the role of time in the political grammar of storytelling. I do share McRobbie's view that disarticulating queer critical feminist and queer thinking from the present can have severe debilitating political consequences. And I cannot help to think that debates such as the one in Norway exemplifies the force of what Sarah Schulman, in her new book, suggestively terms gentrification of the mind, a kind of replacement process where the desire and wish to think and feel differently is dismissed and overrun by a pragmatic and consensus-oriented debate that caters the status quo. It is not necessarily difficult to understand why many people prefer gentrified versions of the present that caters to already known, as it seems to offer a sense of safety, however frail, however cruel, however unequally distributed that safety might be. It is not that difficult to understand why many Norwegians took this state-sponsored TV show on contemporary science research to heart. It was a huge success, as it really spoke to the general audience and told them that it was fair to be fed up with political correctness, and that it was legitimate and even almost scientifically sanctioned to insist on the self-evident fact that men are men, women are women, that gender and sex are stable and inborn features, that white people are smarter than black people, that the social does not have any real impact, and that when people fail to align oneself with a normative order, it is merely a problem of bad genes and bad will. Because systemic change just doesn't work at all. And all those feminist and anti-racist rants about the violence of systemic marginalization and exclusion, and about how language and the social and the culture and categories matter, are nothing but brainwashed ideology that we have listened to long enough. I do worry about the consequences when critical thinking is replaced with an intensification of the status quo. And I might be sensitive, and I might overestimate the power of the Norwegian media, or media for that sake, the power of TV shows, the power of stories, the power of history, the power of the social in general. But this sensitivity grows out of a long-term political depression caused by this form of disarticulation. And seriously, how not to be politically depressed when one sees how the brainwash host, Harald Eia, received the Norwegian Freedom of Speech Honorary Award in 2010 for his ability to really come through with this alternative voice. Or when the self-same guy was invited to lecture at the honorary Norwegian Academy of Science and Letters. Or when the Norwegian Research Council, in the spring of 2010, closed their funding program for gender studies with the argument that targeted funding was no longer needed in a time where critical gender research was already mainstream. It had done its job. So what to do in the face of such historicizing gestures of disarticulation and gentrification of the mind? In a self-proclaimed exceptional country like Norway, who is so in love with its exceptionalism that it prefers to really trivialize any critics of the country's investment in, say, war, or in, say, oil, or insidious state racism, and deadening immigration policies that is usually whitewashed by claiming that it protects vulnerable white LGBT youth from the dangerous immigrants. I could go on, I'm not. But, you know, it's tempting to try to set the record straight and tell the story as it really is or really feels, that queer work, that feminist work, that anti-racist work is timely, it's relevant, it's needed, it's important, in order to counter the increasing homogenization of political alternatives to the status quo. While it is virtually impossible to not want to speak truth to power and kind of refuse this position as a living anachronism in order to be reconnected to the present, I want to insist on the correspondingly importance of lingering on the role we are given as already dead, to borrow Eric Kasten's suggestive figure, for the position inhabited by those who have been killed but are still not dead, those living in this meantime, when the future has already come and is still to come. Well, this chronic time warp of the temporal drag of being positioned as already dead can indeed be uncomfortable and suffocating. The feeling of temporal disorientation that it makes evident might also help us to counter the common sense of the present tense, as Elizabeth Freeman so poignantly argues in Time Binds, it's important to do. So instead of setting history straight then, I've been interested in kind of temporal disoriented historical practices that urges us to rethink the relationship between life and death of theories, as well as bodies, as well as politics, by questioning the separation principle between the past and the present. Suggesting the value of temporal disorientation, of not really knowing what time it is, of being kind of out of time, might seem preposterous in all senses of the world. Unreasonable, absurd, perverse, ridiculous, again, kind of rational orders. But there seem to be queer, kind of certain queer force in preposterousness, both in the sense of the ridiculous, as in the queer art of failing to pass into the regimes of temporal orders, and as well as in the kind of temporal illogical sense, as in queer attempts to find the future in the historical dustbin. Over the last couple of years, I've engaged closely with artistic practices that entertain forms of queer preposterousness, what I kind of think about as queer preposterousness, by disorienting the sense of the present, creating scenes of encounters with pasts that are just not passé, refusing the ordering principle that position unfinished presence in a kind of a forgettable past we can look back upon. I'm thinking, for instance, about works like In the Near Future by Sharon Hayes from New York that many of you probably know, work by Nana Dubois-Boulle on Danish colonialism and historical touches, German artist duo Renate Lorenz and Pauline Baudry's contagious video installations with friends from the past, and Carlos Mata's interdisciplinary queer memory work on re-speaking, just mention a few. My interest in exploring the value of doing temporal disoriented history is also energized by the work of several people in this panel today. Jose's work on Cruising Utopia, Heather's love on backwardness, your love on ecstatic resistance, and your work on the power of storytelling is also inspiring here. And I've turned to aesthetics practices in order to find orienting devices, different forms of orienting devices in time and space. And these kind of works interest me not because they deliver any blueprint of political action in the here and now. The value to me is that Wade refuses to position the present as a stable ground from which we can look back in retrospect on what has been, while simultaneously refusing the past as an anchor point from which we can use to navigate in the present, as Heather was also talking about recently now. These queer artistic and performance practices instead set the stage for really strange encounters where so-called past and so-called present and so-called future touch in different ways, forcing us to ask again and again, what time is it? And when is now? I've tentatively described these practices some of these works, as form of queer archival activism, kind of playing with that whole oxymoronic between the archives' kind of death drive and activism's life drive. But this is an attempt to highlight the ways in which a lot of this work often strive to activate political cases in histories that have been relegated to the drawers of unsolved or forgotten files in the socio-political imaginary. A central feature in these archival activist practices, then, is that they engage the still living remnants of the past in the present, addressing and asserting the importance of long overdue issues of injustice that risk being neglected or positioned as anachronistic within a historical logic invested in chronology and progression. Pointing out irritating presences of historical injustice make you often also come across as an irritating presence yourself. But my point is not to call for a commitment to being temporal disoriented, to make disorientation a demand or a kind of a privileged political state. It's not easy to sit in moments of temporal disorientation. It is demanding and is quite hardly livable. But I am interested in exploring how moments of disorientation can open up new questions and spur a desire to find better ways of approaching the messy concurrencies of the world we live in. And to me, a lot of artistic work could provide opportunities for this by disturbing the separation principle that safely distinguishes the past from the present, the here from the there, and that can call forth a desire to find new orienting devices when navigating politically in time and space. In this weird moment where critical work is increasingly being disarticulated and historicized, to be replaced by consensus-oriented calls to embrace a violently heteronormative and racist common sense present, it seems ever more crucial to think with those artistic and activists who are not scared of coming across as old-fashioned and preposterous when entering into relationship with present pasts and past presents. To return to the Norwegian media debate, if I've learned something of that burial of queer theory in Norway, it is at least that queer work is indeed all about wishful thinking, although I understand this phrase to be all but derogatory. Because a lot of the work I've at least encountered in queer studies and queer artistic practices really harbor a wish to think and feel differently. And in the enactments of this wishful thinking, we might stumble upon moments of temporal disorientation together, moments that indicate that we never really know in advance where the feeling of difference might lead us. Thank you.